I didn't live in Hollywood. I lived in West Los Angeles, but I was very much involved with the whole Hollywood crowd for a while there. I met a lot of celebrities, including the head of the Producers Guild, who encouraged me to write an outline for a pilot for a TV series without telling me you usually get paid for that. He said, I'll see if I can sell it. So I didn't get paid a damn thing for it. And it never went on the air anyway. But something rather like it showed up 2 years later. Well, just slightly like it. Mine was set on a space colony between the Earth and the Moon. Then along came Babylon 5, which was set on a space colony much further out. But the idea of living in a space colony rather than on a planet face seemed very interesting to me. I think it's probably the future. I don't think we're going to colonize other planets. If you climb out of a gravity well, why climb back down into another gravity well? Well, according to G. Harry Stein, a NASA engineer that I have sometimes appeared on panels with, there are 10 to the 100th power of technological processes that can be done cheaper in space than they can be done on a planet face. Eventually, that fact is going to be discovered by the manufacturers of the world. So there'll be a lot of colonies floating around in various parts between planets. And Gerard O'Neill designed a space colony as far back as 1968. It took him 5 years to get that published, like it took Shea and me 5 years to get Illuminatus published. Gerard O'Neill was a physicist teaching at Princeton. How much prestige can you have? A PhD teaching at Princeton? It took 5 years for any physics magazine to publish his article on how to build a space colony with existing technology. And that came out in 73, and now it's the year 2000, and nobody has done it yet. But there's a Japanese group who are putting a hotel in space, and Virgin Airlines has announced they're going to put up a hotel of their own to rival the Japanese hotel. So things are moving in the direction I sort of foresaw.
When are those due to go up?
Oh, in the next 20 years. I'm not sure the exact dates.
What about the International Space Station?
Yeah, that's been up a long time, hasn't it? Yeah, but I mean, what I'm thinking of is a real colony. Mm-hmm. First you get the engineers and the technicians, then you got to have sexual partners for them, then there's going to be children, you're going to need teachers, then they're not going to want everything sent up from Earth, so they're going to start their own farms, which is easy to do in space. Gerard O'Neill included that in his plans way back in 68. And eventually they're going to want movie theaters, art museums, and they're going to want lecturers on subjects like neuro-linguistic programming and general semantics and conspiracy theory.
Are you advertising to be sent into space, Bob?
Well, I'm just dropping a hint. If I'm still around when they get the first space colony, I'm ready to do lectures there if they can provide transportation and a good fee.
So why, you mentioned that you left the United States for 7 years, going to Mexico and Ireland. How come you left?
Well, it wasn't consecutive. I went to Mexico, then to California, then to Ireland, then back to California.
Why did you go to Mexico?
Because I was launching a career as a freelance writer, and I figured my savings would last longer in Mexico than they would in the United States. The reason I went to Ireland is because Arlen and I had said over and over to all of our friends, if Ronald Reagan ever gets elected president, we're getting the hell out of this country. We felt rather embarrassed by hanging around. And besides, we both had a romantic thing about Ireland. We're both part Irish. And in both of our cases, we know more about the Irish side of our ancestry than the other side. I know very little about the Austro-Hungarian, Jewish, Greek, etc., South European side of my ancestry. I know a lot about the Irish side. The same with Arlen. She knows a lot about the Irish side and very little about the Scotch and English side. So, except it seems that both of us were descended from Olaf the Black, who was the king of the Isle of Man in the 9th century or sometime around then. He was one of those Viking pirates. He seized the island, announced that he was the king, And then any ship going from Ireland to England or from England to Ireland had to pay him a duty to pass his Ireland. And we both seemed to be descended from him, according to a genealogist we met in County Westmeath. So our marriage was incestuous to about the 1/1000th of a degree, something like that.
Did you enjoy living in Ireland?
Yeah, I enjoyed it more than Ireland did. Ireland is no country for a feminist. The Catholic Church has so much power. She was continually being irritated. I, on the other hand, having grown up Catholic, found it all very amusing. I found like a rerun of my childhood without being afraid of it anymore, just laughing at it. But she found it irritating. But there was a lot she did like about Ireland, or we wouldn't have stayed there 6 years. And to me, especially Dublin, where we lived, in the vicinity of which we lived, and where we went every day at least, well, not every day, but almost every day. Dublin, to me, is a James Joyce theme park. Anywhere you go, you walk the streets, you go to a restaurant, you go to a pub, you go shopping. Everybody seems to come right out of Ulysses, and they all seem to be talking about the same topics. Everything that Joyce mentions is still there. The Wellington Monument, Boyle Department Store on whatever street it is. And living in Dublin, to me, was like living in the Shire for Tolkien fans, or living in Arkham for H.P. Lovecraft fans. That's one of the things I liked about Los Angeles. I felt I was living in a Raymond Chandler theme park. I'm a big fan of Raymond Chandler.
Do you feel like living in Ireland influenced your writing very heavily?
Yeah, especially, Joyce has been a major influence all my life, but I think while I was in Ireland, two of the books I wrote in Ireland are very Swiftian. I've always liked Swift, but I discovered the closest library had almost every damn thing he ever wrote. So I started taking them out one by one and reading all of Jonathan Swift instead of just Gulliver's Travels and The Modest Proposal, which is all most people have ever read. I read the Drapier Letters and the Tale of the Tub and that one with that wonderful title, Thesis that the Abolition of Christianity Would Not Be in All Respects a Good Thing for England. And all sorts of wonderful stuff. And I can see a very heavy Swift influence on my book, The New Inquisition, which is a satirical attack on fundamentalist materialism. And also my book, Natural Law, which is a Swiftian sort of polemic against people who believe there are natural laws that can be violated. The Pope said that the other day. He said homosexuality is against natural law. Now, I'm willing, like Randy offers $1 million to anybody who can prove psychic abilities to him, which he can't do because he won't let anybody prove it to him. I'm willing to pay $1 million to see anybody do anything against nature. So anything in violation of the laws of nature. I'm convinced it can't be done. And yet a lot of people say some things are against nature. The atom bomb is perfectly natural or it wouldn't work. I don't like it, but it's natural. Bubonic plague is natural or it wouldn't exist. So I wrote Natural Law to beat the hell out of all the people who use natural law as an argument about how we should behave. They all disagree about what's against natural law. The Pope thinks it's homosexuality. The Ayatollah Khomeini claimed that buggering your brother-in-law was worse than buggering a camel, but buggering a camel wasn't as bad as buggering a weasel or something like that. Well, I don't think he consulted any camels and asked their opinions on that issue, you know.
Did you find that living around the, just in the delightful language of Ireland, seeped into your work at all?
Oh, yeah. I curiously enough, it was while I was living in Ireland, I read this poll. I forget where, I guess I must have read it in the Irish Times. Somebody did a poll of the English-speaking world. And it turned out the Irish have the largest average vocabulary of anybody in the English-speaking world. That's larger than the English, the Canadians, the Australians, and us, and whoever else speaks English. And you notice this, the first thing in Ireland. That's because Celtic culture was so largely oral in its great classic pagan days. And then after the English conquest, when Henry VIII went Protestant and they tried to wipe out the Catholic Church in Ireland, to try to abolish it totally, they passed a law that Irish parents could not educate their children. They wanted to make them all illiterate. Muhammad the Great used the same tactic when he conquered India. He tried to reduce all the Hindus to illiteracy. And so there was a long period in which the Irish were deliberately starved of education. Then they found out some of the families were sending their children to France to get educated, so they revised the law. It was against the law to educate an Irish child in Ireland or anywhere else. The English really did this. And that contributed a great deal to oral culture, since there wasn't much literacy under those laws, although some did remain. And then there's the fact that nobody has noticed except Anthony Burgess that English and the rest of the English-speaking world has become more and more functional and rational, whereas English in Ireland is ludic, it's playful, it's a game. Hugh Kenner, one of my favorite literary critics, he defines an Irish fact as having the plasticity of a rubber inch. An Irish fact is anything that makes the conversation livelier and inspires somebody to order another pint. Yeah, Kenner went around trying to find out where James Joyce was baptized. He found three churches claiming they baptized Joyce. And this is only recently, you know. When you find out there were seven heads of St. Denis in the Middle Ages, well, what can you expect of the Middle Ages? But this is only in the last century, you know. Joyce was baptized in 1882, right? It's only a little more than a century ago. And, well, he met a guy who claimed to know the original of Blazes Boylan in Ulysses. And when Kenner was eager for more details, he told him, well, Bloom finally did confront him. Bloom's real name was Hunter, and he confronted him right here in this park where we're talking. The Irish have much more faith in imagination than in science, which is a relief for me because my mind tends to be rather scientific, although my critics won't admit that. Let's say my mind is both scientific and playful at the same time.
Do you consider yourself to be simply a writer as such?
Well, I used to call myself a guerrilla ontologist, which is a term I picked up from somebody in the physics consciousness research group, which I was a member of back in the 70s. This was a bunch of physicists who got together once a week to discuss the philosophical implications of quantum mechanics. And they had a parapsychologist named Barbara Honegger, and I was invited as sort of resident science fiction writer. And somebody used the word guerrilla ontology for what we were doing. I thought it was a good label, so whenever I was interviewed, people asked me, what, your books are so different, what do you call them? And I said, oh, they're guerrilla ontology. And then I got bored with that after a while, and I found two different books in which I was called a postmodernist. And it was really hip to be a postmodernist in the 80s, so I started calling myself a postmodernist. Then I read some more of the postmodernists and found I disagreed with them on almost everything. So now I just call myself a damned old crank. I think that sums it up better than any of my previous titles.
Who are your favorite writers?
Well, James Joyce, Ezra Pound, and even though it's corny, Shakespeare. Shakespeare is an inexhaustible well of a treasury of language and fascinating characterizations, too. I reread something by Shakespeare at least once a year, and I look at Shakespeare films quite frequently. I have a great respect for Homer, but I think I've read the Odyssey about five times, but the last time was about 20 years ago, so I guess Homer is sort of fading into the background finally. Moby Dick I've read four times, and the last time was only 2 years ago, so Moby Dick is a stronger influence than Homer, I guess. Dante, in spite of all the praise heaped upon him by people I respect, I've never been able to stand much of Dante. I like Chaucer, but I can't claim to be much of a Chaucerian. Raymond Chandler and H.P. Lovecraft are my two favorite of the déclassé writers. They're both considered writers of pulp thrillers, not very intellectual and so on. I think they're wonderful. I love their style. I love the way they tell their stories. To me, there's only one detective story writer, and that's Chandler, and there's only one horror story writer, and that's Lovecraft, and all the rest of them are boring, comparatively speaking.
How did you end up getting classified as a science fiction writer?
I don't know.
Because it doesn't really fit.
That fits Schrodinger's cat.
Yeah, true.
The reviewer in New Scientist, which this is one of the greatest reviews I ever got, he said that Schrodinger's cat was obviously written by a committee of nuclear physicists under the pen name Robert Anton Wilson, which he had never heard of before. He said no one quantum physicist could have written it. It had to be a consortium of them. That was the greatest review I ever got. He never thought I was a quantum physicist. He thought I was a whole group of quantum physicists. That's definitely science fiction. How Illuminatus got published as science fiction, I don't know. Somebody at Dell had to decide how to package it. I suggested they should just advertise it as the greatest novel since Don Quixote. They didn't take me very seriously. But I think Don Quixote was a major influence too, by the way. Anyway, they published it as science fiction, and then I wrote Schrodinger's Cat, which was science fiction. Then I wrote Masks of the Illuminati, in which Einstein appears as a character, but it's definitely not science fiction. But by then, my fans were used to looking for me in the science fiction shelf, so that's where all the bookstores put it. Then they started putting my nonfiction in the science fiction shelves, too. And then I heard later, they started moving me into the New Age section, which made me want to go and hide in a cave for a few years. And then I got the great news about a year ago that at least in one bookstore, Barnes & Noble in Philadelphia, I have been moved out of New Age into philosophy. So instead of being next to von Daniken, I'm next to Wittgenstein. I couldn't be happier. That's the best news since New Scientist thought I was a consortium of physicists.
What Shakespeare plays are you interested in?
Oh, all of them, but King Lear has always had a special power. I think Shakespeare's use of language definitely reached a peak somewhere around the years of Hamlet, Macbeth, King Lear, and Othello. And of the whole bunch, I like King Lear the best. I think the language is absolutely staggeringly beautiful in spite of the ugliness of the imagery. It's ugly and beautiful at the same time. Powerful. And I like the others I just mentioned, Hamlet, Othello, etc. And I love the history plays. I even like Henry VI, which everybody considers the least important of the history plays. But if you put the whole thing on in sequence, you start with Richard II and go right through Henry IV, part 1 and 2, Henry V, Henry VI, and then Richard III, you get this panorama. I always compare it to Faulkner's Jognapatofa County novels. It's like every character seems important and then disappears, a new character, and you know, the thing goes on over a period of 300 years. Faulkner's Jognapatofa novels only cover about 140 years, but that kind of epic scope I really like, if the writer is good enough. Everything by Faulkner I've read at least twice, and some of them I've read three or four times.
Isn't that one of the things you're doing in the historical Illuminatus trilogy?
Well, yeah, all of my novels do, if I ever get around to writing the missing volumes, we'll have a continuous story beginning in 1766 in Naples and ending in the year 20-something, I don't know, in a space colony. Because a lot of the same families, the Babcocks, keep popping up throughout the series. The Chileans keep popping up. The Wildebloods appear now, and then the Moons or Moons keep showing up. And so I've got my own world moving in parallel to real history. there's my imaginary history, which keeps interacting with real history. My favorite, by the way, is The Widow's Son, because by the time I finished that, I was absolutely convinced, and I remain persuaded, that nobody, not even me, can tell how much of that is true and how much of it I invented. And I think if you got 10 historians to go over the book line by line, they'd all viciously disagree with one another. That's a technique I learned from H.P. Lovecraft, mixing fact and fiction in a way that gets the reader to wonder, Jesus, maybe even the worst parts of this are true. I learned that from Lovecraft. I gave it a humorous twist in Illuminatus. I give it a sinister twist in some of my other books. But I like keeping the reader uncertain as to how much of this you should believe. That's because I'm not so sure about how much I should believe about what I read in the papers or see on television. I don't believe much of what I read in the papers or see on television. I don't believe much of what I see out my window either, for that matter. I one time shocked the hell out of Bob Shea by saying, I see 3 or 4 UFOs a week. And he looked at me like, my God, you have finally gone nuts. And I said, well, what the hell? I've been trained in general semantics for over 40 years. I'm not quick to identify things. Most of the things that go by in the sky are unidentified. As far as I don't know what they are. They could be satellites, they could be airplanes, they could be spaceships, they could be sun dogs, they could be swamp gas. I'm not sure. But for that matter, I see at least 10 UNFOs every week. That's unidentified non-flying objects. Things go by out there. I don't know what the hell they are. I'm just not quick to identify things. I'm uncertain about almost everything, including my own uncertainty. But that comes back to my fascination with Taoism. One text in the Tao Te Ching says, everybody else is full of robust certitude. I alone am tentative. At least that's one translation of the Tao Te Ching. I've read about 20, and they all disagree with one another.
Besides writers, what thinkers do you feel have influenced you the most?
Alfred Korzybski, definitely in first place. I read Korzybski when I was about 18, and then I reread him several times in my 20s when I was first learning to smoke pot. And reading Korzybski on pot is absolutely the best way to read him. Every general semanticist in the country is going to hate me for saying that, but Korzybski's basic thesis is that all perception is co-creation. The brain is the center of our consciousness, but the consciousness is all over the body. He hardly ever uses the word brain. He keeps talking about the nervous system. We are evaluating with our whole nervous system all the time. Our whole organism is involved in the process of creating the environment we think we are perceiving. I'm not saying we're making it up out of whole cloth. We're making it up out of signals we receive. But we make it up to suit our own intents and our own dogmas, if we have dogmas, our own emotion, our own aesthetics even. And everybody lives in a different universe. And reading that on pot, it was easy to understand. A lot of people can't understand Korzybski, and I always tell them, well, read him while you're stoned, and then you begin to understand. And one of the main things I got from Korzybski was, I call it neurological relativism. I forget when I coined that term, but it's parallel to Einstein's instrumental relativism. Every nervous system perceives a different universe. And at my workshops, I have various ways of demonstrating this. I have people describe the hall they came through to get into the seminar room, and no two people describe it exactly alike. I've never had a case where two people in the class describe the same hall. Sometimes the differences are quite astonishing. Then I have listening experiments where they all listen. They all hear different sounds, which is partly because they're in different parts of the room, but it's also because we're attuned to different sounds depending on our life history, our education, and probably our genetics even. And anyway, we're all living in our own worlds that we created, made up out of some common stuff that's common to all of us, so we wouldn't be able to communicate at all. But most of the defects of communication, according to Koshybsky, are caused by the fact we think everybody's living in the same world with us. And when we find out they're not, we think they're either crazy or evil, they're either mad or bad. And learning to accept neurological relativism, I think, is one of the great liberating discoveries of the 20th century. And it's not just in Koshybsky, it's been discovered over and over again under various labels, but Koshybsky put it, I think, in the best terms. And the other thing I got from Koshybsky of tremendous importance, I got many things, but the second, the one I want to mention right now, the concept of time binding, which is that language allows information to accumulate more and more rapidly as time passes. Now, that's a commonplace thought, but when Koshybsky wrote it in 1933, it was a totally unexpected thought, and he was attacked by the evolutionists for implying there might be such a thing as progress instead of just random chance. But what Koshybsky meant was that due to language, I can receive signals from Confucius. As a matter of fact, I got an edition of Confucius with the Chinese on one page and the English translation on the facing page, and I can read some of the ideograms. I can receive signals from Heraclitus, Plato, etc., etc. And I can receive signals from the latest scientific publications that are online. And so as time passes, more and more information becomes more and more available to more and more people, which means more and more changes in technology, which means more and more changes in society. So I read Koshybsky around 1950, I guess, and the last 50 years have not surprised me at all. I've been expecting rapid changes. In the last year, all the sudden breakthroughs, I've been expecting them all along. I've been expecting we're going to go into space long before anybody else was expecting it. Now the acceleration of information has reached the point where I think it's totally out of control and nobody can stop it. The only way they can stop it is by forming a world government of a totalitarian nature. And the people who most want to control communication are the people who are most afraid of world governments. So they'll never get together to form a world government, so they'll always be. Freedom is increasing all the time because on internet you can publish anything. And if they stop you in one place, you just route it through the Netherlands and it comes right back onto the web in the United States again. And Nietzsche has always been a major influence, not Zarathustra. The whole Superman thing, I don't care much for. What I like is Nietzsche's later works where he tears philosophy to shreds and destroys all of our ordinary concepts of common sense and the self, the ego, the concrete real world. And
so Beyond Good and Evil and those books.
And Twilight of the Idols and The Antichrist and The Will to Power. And Karl R. Popper was a major influence for a long time. Well, I've read a lot of the philosophers who are trying to make sense out of modern science philosophically, and next to Koshybsky, I would say Popper has had the biggest influence on me. And then there's Benjamin Tucker, who was absolutely the best writer in the individualist anarchist tradition. And even though individualist anarchism sounds rather extreme, most of Tucker's ideas are, well, not most, but let's say about three-quarters of his ideas are pretty much accepted by the Libertarian Party now, and more and more Americans are beginning to sense the world the way Tucker sensed it.
When was he writing?
Well, he did most of his writing between the 1880s and 1914. He appeared for a while in a magazine called The New Free Woman, edited by Harriet Shaw Weaver, who also was publishing James Joyce and Ezra Pound in every issue. And Joyce apparently read Tucker because he told somebody in Paris that Tucker had the clearest head ever in politics. And he seems to have influenced Pound, too, because Pound uses the word usury exactly the way Tucker used it, to describe the manipulation of currency in order to make a profit on the exchange rate.
Isn't that the definition, though?
No, the definition is an excessive charge, an excessive interest charge. That's the current definition. Mm. The Aristotelian definition was any interest charge.
That's what I thought it was, just interest of any kind.
Well, no, in the modern world, because interest is so widespread, they've had a change. It's excessive interest is now called usury. Anyway, Benjamin Tucker, Karl Popper, Alfred Koshybski, Friedrich Nietzsche, and who else? Timothy Leary. How the hell could I leave him out? Timothy Leary, Harry Stack Sullivan, Eric Byrne, Sullivan and Byrne. Sullivan seems like a great predecessor of Leary, and Byrne seems like a great popularizer of Leary without the psychedelics. Leave out the psychedelics, and Byrne is just repeating Leary. What Leary, in his first book called Transactions, Byrne called games, about the same time Leary started calling them games. Wilhelm Reich, which just goes to show the effects of censorship. I was reading a lot of psychology, I always have, but I probably never would have gotten turned on to Reich if the government hadn't burned his books. That got me curious. Who is this man that so terrorized the American government that they were afraid to leave his books in circulation and collected them all and burned them in an incinerator in New York? I went around every place in New York, everybody I knew in New York, trying to find somebody who owned one or two of his books. I found somebody who wouldn't lend them to me. They were too valuable at that point. But I could go to his apartment in the afternoon and read them. And I thought Reich made a great deal of sense. On the psychological and neurological level. I wasn't so sure about the Oregon. Now I found a bibliography of 400 scientific papers confirming Reich's basic Oregon experiments. So I'm beginning to reconsider the Oregon theory, too.
You can buy a lot of Oregon-based products online, too. Interesting.
Yes. Yeah, this bibliography, it's by James DeMayo, and it has 400 papers by over 100 scientists confirming Reich's basic experiments. And there's been two PhDs granted in Germany for experiments duplicating Reich's Oregon accumulator experiments. And yet the so-called skeptics, as I call them, the people who call themselves skeptics but never doubt their own dogmas, the gang that put out the Skeptical Inquirer, every time they mention Reich, they say his work has never been confirmed. Which just goes to show they're so damn dogmatic they don't bother to study a subject before they pontificate on it, or they're fucking liars. I don't know which. I tend to suspect they're so goddamn dogmatic they don't bother examining the evidence for the, and they don't know that there are this many papers confirming Reich. Although they should know, James DeMayo, the guy who did the bibliography, sent them a copy of it. He got a polite note back about why they didn't have room to print that.
I'll bet.
Aleister Crowley has been a major influence.
Well, that's unusual. How has he influenced you?
Well, it started out with Alan Watts. I was having dinner with Alan Watts, and I mentioned the Illuminatus book that Shay and I were writing, and the idea that the eye on the pyramid on the dollar bill is the secret symbol of the Illuminati, which I thought was one of the crazier conspiracy theories. And Alan Watts said, that reminds me, the best book I've read all year is called The Eye and the Triangle. It's a biography of Aleister Crowley. Well, I thought Alan was a pretty bright guy, and if he recommended a book, so I went and read this biography of Crowley, and that got me hooked. I started reading everything I could find by Crowley. Then I started doing his magical exercises, and I started getting results. And I don't think of it in terms of anything supernatural, neither did Crowley. And when his essay, The Psychology of Hashish, he says, thank God I'm an atheist. I think he may have been the first one to have said that. Crowley's magic is a technique for changing your level of consciousness in various interesting ways, and you can quite easily go totally nuts with his technique if you're not careful. If you are careful, you might survive. Whether I've gone nuts or one of the survivors is a matter about which I cannot speak objectively.
How would you say he influenced you, though?
Well, he combined techniques. He was a kind of eclectic. He started out with European Rosicrucian tradition. Then he got into the sex magic side of European Rosicrucianism. Then he studied Buddhism in Ceylon with a real Buddhist teacher. Then he went to India and studied yoga there. Then he studied Sufism in North Africa. And then he built up this system which combines several different mystical traditions with a very scientific procedure. You do the exercise, the ritual, the yoga position, whatever, and you make notes on what happens afterwards, and you keep what he called a magical diary. And you see what you're doing to yourself and which direction you're developing in. And if you're developing in a goofy direction, you start doing a different type of exercise. If you know what you're doing, if you have enough common sense to know you're going goofy. Of course, at one stage of doing a lot of Crowley work, I was convinced I was receiving communications from an extraterrestrial, but that didn't last too long. Later, I decided it was my right brain talking to my left brain. Or at least that's what I say when I'm speaking to scientific groups. To me, the metaphors, the explanations don't matter. What matters is the ability to change your consciousness.
Do you still find Crowley cogent for you personally?
Yeah, but there's a lot of infighting in the among Crowleyans, which I don't want to get involved in, so I tend to avoid getting too close to the organized thelemic movements because they're all denouncing one another currently as frauds. One of them is even claiming another has actually been taken over by Scientology. I don't know what the hell is going on. Paranoia is epidemic in the occult world. I once asked Israel Rigardi, who was a psychotherapist,
and also the author of I Am the Triangle, right?
Yeah, that's right. And he was also Crowley's secretary back in the 20s. I asked him why paranoia is so common among occult circles. He said, well, they activate the forehead chakra before they activate the heart chakra, which any Hindu will tell you is a dangerous thing to do. So they start developing strange powers and psychic abilities and weird insights and whatnot, but they haven't opened the heart, so they don't have enough love to deal with this, and it all turns into terrifying demon images which they project on other occultists. I think that makes perfect sense to me. I did a lot of heart chakra work before I did any of the Ajna chakra.
In the Sufi tradition? Or?
Yeah, yeah. One of my daydreams is to have a convention with Sufis, sub-genii, and E.J. Gold's crowd, and the O.T.O., the Crowley, the Thelemic group. The Sufi symbol is the heart with wings. Crowley symbol is an empty circle with wings, like the empty circle in Zen Buddhism. And E.J. Gold's symbol is Gurdjieff's enneagram with wings. And the subgenius symbol is a watch with a knife through it with wings, which represents slack. And Clint Eastwood, I sometimes suspect, is a subgenius because in the Iger Sanction, there's a scene in which he cries with great sincerity, "Give me slack!" And that can't be a coincidence, can it? Or am I putting you on now? And will Clint ever hear this? And what will he think if he does?
So, Bob, you, in your writings, have address so many different areas and so many different issues. What do you think unites all your work?
Ezra Pound was asked to contribute to a magazine honoring Wyndham Lewis after his death, and Pound liked to write brief, terse things quite frequently. Sometimes he wrote longer things like the cantos, but he liked to write brief things, and for the Wyndham Lewis memorial he wrote, "I still treasure Wyndham Lewis, the man who was wrong about everything except the superiority of live mind to dead mind, for which he should live forever." I'm not sure I got that quote exactly right, but I got it basically right. And that's my basic thing, is live mind versus dead mind. Live, inquiring, curious, uncertain, tentative mind versus dogmatic, closed, frozen, constipated mind. That's what ties all my interests together.
So curiosity.
Curiosity, yeah, which allegedly killed a cat once. It hasn't killed me yet. Although some people think it has. Have you heard about the Robert Anton Wilson android?
Isn't that who I'm speaking with now?
Well, some people think so. Back around 94, somebody put a fake news story online, allegedly from the Los Angeles Times, claiming I died of a heart attack. And there was a lot of argument about whether this was true or it was a hoax. And then people who have spoken to me on the phone wrote, I've spoken to Wilson and he is still alive. And then there were the hoax ones that said they contacted me at my home in Hoth Castle. I live near Hoth Castle, but I never lived in Hoth Castle. And I said, I'm not, the reports of my death have been exaggerated. This guy was lifting that from Mark Twain. But then he added a line that really does sound like me. I still totter about a bit and can crack a weak joke now and then. And then somebody else came back with all the people who claimed to have met me or talked to me on the phone. Since my death, they were all deceived. The CIA killed me and replaced me with a Robert Anton Wilson android. And having read a lot of Philip K. Dick, I knew if that was true, I'd be the last one to know it because, as Phil Dick pointed out, a fully functioning android would have to believe it was whoever it was supposed to be acting like. So if I was an android pretending to be Robin Anton Wilson, I would think I am Robin Anton Wilson. See, surrounded by epistemological quandaries like that, how can my mental life ever cease? I've always got something to wonder about. I swear to God, I wasn't the one who suggested the CIA. That was somebody else. It sounds like something I might have thought of, but I didn't. I have been responsible for getting into print and online about 20 times now the report that the face on Mars has definitely been identified by computer enhancement of the photographs. And this has been done by Professor Timothy F. X. Finnegan of the Royal Sir Miles Nicholson Astroanomalistic Society in Dalkey, Ireland. And well, it turns out to be Moishe Horowitz, who can now be considered a major influence on two planets. I never give a show business name. I leave readers to figure that out for themselves. Moishe Horowitz was the birth name of Mo Howard of the Three Stooges. And as a matter of fact, if you look at most photographs of the face on Mars, it looks more like Mo Howard than anyone else. Well, at least to me. Somebody actually published a whole book arguing the face on Mars was Elvis Presley. At least I know when I'm joking. I think that guy probably believed his own theory.
Bob, how many kids have you had?
Four.
And one marriage, correct?
That's right, yeah. Well, I didn't need more than one marriage. The first one worked fine. It's still working.
How is that?
I know everything I do. I know what are, not everything. She was a bit unpredictable. All intelligent people are. But and most of the things that I do or say or look at on television, I know what her opinion of them would be. So it's like she's still living with me.
You're still having an interaction?
Yeah, we're still interacting. And you don't have to be spiritualistic about it. Our nervous systems imprinted each other over a 42-year period. Mm. So she's still here. I don't feel out of touch with her entirely, somewhat, but not entirely. And she's in most of my dreams. I had a weird dream last night where we were at a party and we were dancing. And there was nothing in the dream to make me think it was odd that she should be alive. In the dream, I forgot she was dead. And I forgot that I'm disabled and can't dance. And we're dancing, and then I noticed that nobody else was dancing. It was all old friends, and they all were walking on canes. And I said to Arlen, you know, we're getting old. We're going to be walking on canes someday ourselves. And then I woke up and realized whether the dream had just reversed reality. George Carlin says that when people tell me you're getting older, I say, bullshit, I'm getting old, let's face it.
Did you talk to the illustrious Dr. Leary before he passed on?
Yes, and I'd be happy to tell that story. It's one of my favorites of all my Leary anecdotes. I was visiting him as often as I could in the last months. And the last time, everybody knew he only had a few weeks, days, nobody was sure. And as I left, I said, Timothy, I want to tell you, I've met Buckminster Fuller, and I still think you're the most intelligent man I ever met. I've met George Carlin, and I still think you're the funniest man I ever met. And Timothy, sitting there in his wheelchair, grinned at me and said, Bob, you're an excellent judge of character. That's my, well, no, I got another favorite Leary. I got 100 favorite Leary stories, but I'll let you off with just one more. A month after his death, I got an email from him. It said, Dear Robert, he always called me Robert. Everybody else calls me Bob. I don't know why. He always called me Robert. And he insisted that everybody call him Tim instead of Timothy. Anyway, he always called me Robert. And this email said, Dear Robert, how are you doing? I'm doing fine over here, but it's not what I expected. Too crowded. Love, Timothy. I felt very honored. However he worked that, by whatever processes, spiritualistic or techno or cybernetic, it was a great joke.
If you could wish, I guess, for people to get one thing out of all your work, what would that be?
Well, more open-mindedness, more sense of humor, and more optimism. I don't think there's a single problem facing this planet that can't be solved. I think some of them, the solutions already exist. The problem is implementing the solutions, getting the power elite to recognize that this is in their own best interest, too, to allow some changes to occur. Well, I said it earlier, pessimists don't start computer companies, they don't start anything. Pessimists do nothing but sit around and bitch. Everything is done by the optimists. Besides, somebody named, I think, Barefoot, who may or may not be an American Indian, it may be an old Norwegian name for all I know. A psychologist named Barefoot published some statistics which seem to indicate that optimists outlive pessimists by an average of 19 years, which encourages me to go on being a blithering optimist in spite of all the voices of... I got one guy in Hawaii really pissed off at me. He kept sending me these doomsday announcements about Y2K, and I kept sending him back the craziest apocalyptical Christian prophecies, which he did not take as seriously as Y2K. He stopped writing to me finally, alas.
So all in all, you're trying to spread a little light?
Well, humor, skepticism, open-mindedness, and optimism. Or as Alan Miller likes to say, he's a psychologist, a good friend of mine, have a little fun, make a little money, do a little good. I think that's as good a life script as anybody can imagine.
This concludes session 1. Our program continues with session 2.